Hello and welcome to Cave 76, the only podcast featuring everything important in the realm of unimportance. I'm Rami.
And I'm Frank. This week we'll take a look at international politics as seen through the lens of two hard-hitting documentaries, The Prince of Persia and MacGruber. And we'll take you to a wacky little island in the South Pacific, where it's always fiesta time. But first, Rami.
Yes, Frank.
I can't believe we still have listeners, but we have listener questions.
Oh, it's good to be back and good to be answering listener questions.
Is it?
Yeah, it is.
Reserve judgment.
All right, fair enough.
No. All right, we have a... we apologize that it took us so long to get to this question because it was posted in an iTunes review.
Yeah, you really should email or Twitter at us, but whatever.
And you can, of course, do that at cave76podcast@gmail.com.
Uh-huh. Or Twitter at us at thesickness83 or at Frank Angonis. But we digress.
But we have a couple of questions coming from Aaron. And Aaron wants to know, what film has the best soundtrack? American Graffiti, Sister Act, Big Chill, Dirty Dancing, your thoughts? Maybe City Lights, a tinka tinka clinka clinka, a tinny piano.
The best soundtrack, I assume he's talking about a soundtrack composed entirely of already released music.
I suppose so, yeah, not like a score, because we could right. go on for ages and days about scores.
Yeah, I think one of them that he mentioned, American Graffiti, is the one that kind of pops into head, mm-hmm. into my head first. I think there's just, you know, credit George Lucas for a lot of things, but good and bad in the world of film, but one of the great things he did was he created that first, you know, jukebox of hits, and at the time, those songs were not... played in heavy rotation, and the licensing fees for them was really cheap. And now, you know, all those songs are classics. It's really the great American song canon from that era.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Frank?
Well, I mean, there are a couple that I've listened to ad nauseum back when I had my back in my Discman days. You know, I always used to pop in the Kill Bill Volume 1 soundtrack, which is really excellent. Particularly when compared to the Kill Bill Volume 2 soundtrack. But I'm going to have to go with Footloose.
Oh. You gotta cut loose?
Footloose. I'm going to kick off my Sunday shoes.
Well, that's fitting.
Yeah, it features such songs as Kenny Loggins' Footloose.
Huh?
Denise Williams' Let's Hear It for the Boy. Bonnie Tyler's Holding Out for a Hero. Shalimar's Dancing in the Streets.
Oh, yes. Let's not forget Shalimar.
Carla Bonoff's Somebody's Eyes Are Watching. And Sammy Hagar, Girl Gets Around. Oh, John Mellencamp, Hurts So Good. See, it's too much.
Hurts So Good. Did Hurts So Good premiere with Footloose? Was that the first time?
I think it may have.
Oh, wow.
And Quiet Riot's Bang Your Head.
Oh, solid. I would love to hear a special edition recording of the soundtrack with John Lithgow singing all those songs.
Yeah, well, it also helps. The fact that the soundtrack is one of my favorite is also helped by the ludicrous musical, Broadway musical production
of
Footloose, which has all of these songs sung by a cheery ensemble of bright-eyed young ingenues. And, of course, as people who knew me in high school will attest to, I had a thing where I would listen to the Footloose soundtrack in my car and sing along as Placido Domingo.
I am completely unsurprised to hear this.
And let me tell you, you have not lived until you've heard Placido Domingo sing Holding Out for a Hero. It's pretty good.
We may ask for some of that on a special episode in the future.
Out where the mountains meet the heaven above, out where the lightning splits the sea, I can swear there is someone somewhere watching me. Yeah.
I missed this a lot.
Did you really?
I did.
I will not be downloading this episode.
All right. What other questions we got, Frank?
Aaron has a follow-up question, although it doesn't actually follow up the previous question.
Right.
And he wants to know about Rob Reiner. And who doesn't? Yep.
Yeah, sure.
Aaron asks, is Rob Reiner's streak of excellent films followed by crappy films some unique occurrence? I mean, in the 80s and 90s, this is Spinal Tap, Princess Bride, Stand By Me, When Harry Met Sally, then Misery and A Few Good Men. And in the late 90s to 2000s, crap. Billy Wilder had similar issues, right?
So is he asking if Billy Wilder had similar issues to Rob Reiner?
I think he's asking if Rob Reiner is the new Billy Wilder.
I'm
just going to go out on a limb and say no. I could see where that comparison could be made, I suppose.
You know, I think there's a very clear point of demarcation for Rob Reiner, and I think it's very obvious when you're looking at the filmography. That is, 2 years after A Few Good Men, North comes out, and North, you know, was a massive, massive critical commercial flop, and I think it's really his
first. I mean, it was the reason that Roger Ebert wrote a book of negative film criticism.
Yeah, that would be I hated this movie. So you know, I think if my Hollywood apocrypha is solid, I believe what happened with North is that Reiner had a very specific concept coming in. And the studio tinkered with it. Some people in his all-star cast, including Bruce Willis, tinkered with it until the movie that he ended up making was unrecognizable from the one he had intended to make because he had compromised so much.
Well, but Rami, right after North, he made The American President, which I think we can all agree is a pretty damn solid movie.
It's true. It's true. But, you know, it's weird.
Granted, more so for Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah,
but still, I mean, for people who don't know, The American President, I think we've talked about it on the podcast before, was a progenitor to The West Wing.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's even got Martin Sheen in it.
It does indeed. Yeah, I mean, there's after that, he had The Story of Us, which I did not see. He had Ghosts of Mississippi, which I did not see. Alex and Emma, which I did not see. Rumor has it I did see The Bucket List.
I saw Rumor Has It on HBO. It is awful.
You saw what on HBO?
Rumor has it. Yeah.
I saw The Bucket List with my parents. It was fine.
It
made a lot of money. I mean, here's the thing. Yeah. I don't know. It's not a. You know, this isn't a phenomenon that is unique to Rob Reiner. I mean, look, as films go on, you know, there are a couple of theories about this, right? There's, you know, either a filmmaker loses touch, or it's not the right word, but it's like, you know, a filmmaker doesn't necessarily adapt to the changing climate, or the climate changes around him, and that's not, you know, what he was doing before is not necessarily what he would like to be doing now. A lot of times, also, directors can burn out.
Sure.
Yeah, it's happened a lot.
You look at someone like Francis Ford Coppola or Woody Allen, and while I still think they're wonderful directors and I still think they've got great films left in them, I think their best days are kind of in the rear view.
Yeah, well, point. I mean, at a certain point, it's, you know, the difference between a fresh young director who has a new and vital thing to say that is unlike everything else, and then, you know, look at Woody Allen's a good example. It's like, it was absolutely important and vital and funny and necessary, and then everyone started doing it. I mean, it's kind of like how – this is going to be a stretch. It's kind of like how I didn't like Aliens because I saw it just like 4 years ago.
I see. So the style and the
had
been, content has
been
so
I mean
disseminated.
Every action film wants to be Aliens.
Every video game wants to be Aliens.
But yeah, as for Billy Wilder, I mean, he had some real gems in that tail end there. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's really hard to, you know, people peak.
Yeah, and also the type of comedy that people responded to changed rather significantly.
Yeah.
And even when you look at a later Billy Wilder film like Avanti, where people are swearing and it's a little more sexually direct, it feels a little weird. It's like
you get to see a naked Jack Lemmon in that movie. A naked Jack Lemmon circa 1983.
Yeah, I don't really know how to respond to that.
You do with the only logical way you can. And that's to go blind.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, right? I mean, directors have peak. I mean, some would even argue that Spielberg, you know.
Yeah, there's a huge internet contingent that says that Spielberg has peaked.
I would not say that.
You know, but he hasn't made a movie since, what's it called? Indiana Jones and the Crushing Disappointment.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I'm excited. I'm actually really excited about Super 8, the more that I hear about it.
Yeah, could be really cool.
Super 8, for people who don't know, is the new J.J. Abrams movie, the teaser of which was in front of Iron Man 2. And it's produced by Steven Spielberg, and Abrams is specifically shooting it and has written it in the mind of his, you know, as an homage almost to his favorite era of Spielberg, you know, the early 80s Spielberg. And
yeah. The suburbia under siege by the abnormal.
Yeah. From what I've heard, or all the rumors I've heard, it's about a group of like 12 to 13 year olds who are making silly Super 8 movies in their backyard, and they accidentally catch glimpse of an escaped alien transport from Area 51 to wherever they were moving in. I don't know.
So it's basically the best scene in Signs blown up to feature length.
Yeah, I mean, the trailer didn't do much. In fact, it elicited a couple of laughs in the audience.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting, because people were excited when I saw it.
Yeah, but we'll see.
It's true. Yeah, it could be fun. Could be really cool. And I love it how – I kind of love that a J.J. Abrams movie comes out of nowhere. Like, there's no news of it. And then,
it's pretty much the only way it can, you know. I mean, he's trying to squeeze it in before
next start.
Star Trek 2, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so, wow, what a
strange, wonderful journey that question took us on.
Thanks for the listener questions, and as always, please keep them coming.
Love to get them.
Previously on Frank's Lost Theory of the Week.
It's Frank's Lost Theory of the Week.
Because, of course, we're talking about the forces of light and evil. Yes. So Jacob calls me up, and he says, hey, listen up, Frank. It's me, Jacob. Robots? Pope Benjamin.
No, Pope Frank! I am Peter O'Toole. I take a whiskey drink, I take a vodka drink. That's what attracted me to this project. President played, crashed onto a prison island.
Yes.
Rescued by Kurt Russell playing Snake Plissken from Escape from New York, which you've never seen.
The made-for-TV movie Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island.
She's sort of like a lemur or a tarsier.
Yeah. You awesome. Got a theme song!
I sure did.
Maybe you didn't get it. I know you're a little dense on these matters.
Run! Go! Get to the chopper!
Lost.
Whew! I cannot wait to see the thrilling conclusion to that, Rami.
Wait, was there a commando?
No,
there was a line from Commando in
no,
there.
No, that was season two. A lot of people don't remember season two of Frank's Lost Theory of the Week.
I see.
You know, it was a bit maligned.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that happened.
Yes, it did. What a long, strange ride it's been.
So of course, the Lost finale occurred just this past Sunday, and we watched it.
Oh, we did.
This is true. And there's a lot of talk back and forth on the internet. It was good. It was not. It was crushing disappointment. It was transcendent luminosity. It was the cure for cancer. It was cancer.
pretty intense polarities on the internet.
Yes, you know it, you know it's funny. The internet doesn't deal with degrees.
No, it doesn't.
You know, it's not a, it's not a shades of gray type place. But yeah, so Rami, we watched the finale. What did you think of the finale and Lost as a whole?
Okay, well, I really enjoyed the finale. I found it to be enormously emotionally satisfying to see these characters have the resolutions they wanted, or that we wanted for them. I thought.
Let's be pretty clear on this. Spoilers.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, there's spoilers obviously for all going of to Lost. Be. Yes. Yeah, obviously we're going to talk about all of Lost here.
Yeah.
And you know, I felt like I didn't need every one of those. Questions answered for me to enjoy the show, and I think a lot of people watch the show with an eye to why, but when really the question that people are should be asking is how, or how do we if yeah, a lot of people watching the show with if then what. yeah, it was I liked the on island action, I liked the sideways action. It was a very enjoyable watching experience. How about you, Frank?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I think your enjoyment of the finale was directly dependent on what kind of Lost watcher you were.
Yes, very fair point.
You know, there are people that were very much into the mystery aspect of it, and all the science and the technobabble and the... electromagnetics and why is this and why is there polar bears and the whole thing.
Magnets. How do they work?
Yeah. But I felt the series got so convoluted with all that stuff around season 2 and 3, and it started being very difficult to kind of figure out and trace where everything was going. So around season 2, I stopped caring and just, you know, accepted every crazy new sci-fi mystery that was thrown at us as like, oh yeah, and then that happened. And it allowed me to get more invested in the characters. And really, I mean, the characters were my constant, Rami.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bold.
Yeah. And I think the finale made the argument that they were each other's constants.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I think.
I liked the finale a lot. even the last 5 minutes, which is the polarizing thing, right? It's the big polarizing. Everyone agrees. It's like, oh, it was pretty. Yeah, no, it was a really good show until that last 5 minutes, where
right.
All of a sudden religion showed up and was all like, blah blah blah.
Well, here's the thing about that. I think. They choose their vague words very carefully on this show. And I think if you go back and watch both the finale and the first episode of this season, you paint a picture of what the sideways world is. And it isn't, and I'd be very wary to call it purgatory.
I agree.
I think it's because in encompassing all times and all experiences and knowing what we know about Ben and Hurley and what they're tasked with by the end of the episode, I think that this is a world where people are connecting and have an easier time to try to achieve a kind of happiness. Because when you look at the list of all these characters, they all came to the island very much flawed and very much in need of a critical moment of change or a shift in perspective. And what the sideways world does is it does that without having to deal with the hardships that were presented to them on the island. And that very much feels like a construct. And it feels like a kind of construct that Hurley, in his infinite compassion, would create. And I think that moment right outside the church is even more telling than the moment with Jack and his father. Because at that point, you're saying very much that Ben and Hurley took very specific action, very different from what was happening before with Jacob and MIB. What do you think about that, Frank?
I actually thoroughly agree with that. I thought I came to a very similar conclusion.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the idea that Jacob's Island was a way in actual life of allowing people to gain some kind of redemption through force and violence and human beings and a fundamental mistrust of human beings that
yes
that has kind of been played up definitely this season, but I think a lot through the series. You know, who can you trust? What is it that human beings will do to each other when faced with their own survival amidst incomprehensible circumstances? And if that was a way of getting everyone to become all right with who they were, then it seems that the Flash Sideways universe was very much the Hurley, you know, taking care of people, kinder, gentler form of redemption. And I like that theory a lot. Well, there were 10 to 15 minutes cut out of the already very long finale.
Yeah.
2.5 hour finale is Christ. Yeah. Already cut out of the finale that are just Ben and Hurley running the island. And I imagine, and they're going to be released on the
DVD
set, which pretty much guarantees that everyone will buy that DVD set.
Very clever.
Very savvy. But I think that theory holds, and it actually holds true with one thing. You know, everyone was like, ugh, so they've been dead the whole time in the Flash Sideways. Let's get this out of the way. The island all existed. The island was all real.
Yeah.
And to my mind, the Flash Sideways was real. It was not like some sort of afterlife and purgatory, et cetera. It was a construct created by Hurley and Ben. I would have liked it had they not all jumped into that huge glowy light thing at the end.
Yeah.
I could have done without that because that kind of... That felt pat, you know, when they opened the whole door. But here's something that goes along with your theory that I think stands up, Rami. And the question is, how much in the episode this season, in the Desmond episode this season,
mm-hmm.
What did Desmond experience during that giant electromagnetic flash on the island? We thought that what was happening was that he flashed over to the Flash Sideways universe,
right.
And then lending credence that it was some kind of alternate or future universe.
Right.
And he gained incredible clarity in the Flash Sideways universe. What my question for you, Rami, is if that was the afterlife,
right?
How was Desmond able to flash into it?
Well, I see what I'm saying. Sure. Well, hadn't the whole thing been that the device that Widmore used had been killing all previous subjects? I mean, wasn't that the situation there?
But we've reconciled that Desmond is different. Desmond has a high tolerance for electromagnetism, which makes him uniquely suitable to be a member of the X-Men.
Right. Exactly. God, this, you know, I swear when you say some of this stuff out loud, it is so dumb. Which is really good that they didn't ever sit down and explain it out line for line why they did all this, because it would sound ridiculous.
Wait, was there ever an X-Man who was just like, I'm made of plastics?
No, not really.
Marvel, I await your call.
Yeah, I'm made of plastics. No. the whole concept is ludicrous, Frank.
So anyway, back to the electromagnetic island.
Seriously. So what's the question then? What did Desmond see if he didn't?
Yeah, what did Desmond see? My theory is that because Desmond was able to flash when he was bombarded with that electromagnetism this season.
Yeah.
And again, we're not sure whether he did what exactly he witnessed, but I feel like he must have witnessed that.
He's got to have seen the sideways, right? And I think
because if not, what did he see?
It's got to be the sideways. Because here, look, think about
it. And
how soothing, how relaxed would you be in the ultimate way you carried on if you knew for a fact that at whatever time it happens, you know, when you go, when it's your time, you know that you will be taken to a place where you are surrounded by people you love and people you care about and all will be well. I mean, I think there is something very liberating about that, and it has that kind of sense of it's very freeing.
Well, and in the finale, when all hell breaks loose and Desmond pulls the Desmond pulls the shoddy metaphor out of the island. you know, there was you know, he's shocked because he thinks that pulling the cork out of the island will lead to the alternate reality. He tells Jack, I don't know what happened. I thought it was all supposed to change, or we were supposed to go to a better, you know, to this better other alternate universe, which tells me that yes, he did travel to that Flash Sideways universe. And if he could travel to that Flash Sideways universe, I don't think it would make much sense. I don't think the Lost creators, or it doesn't jibe with them, that they'd be able, that they were saying that Desmond was flashing back and forth to the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? So I think that adds more credence to the idea that this is some other separate island that Hurley and Ben have created. But I may be wrong. It seems like this is, of all of the post-Lost answers that we're going to get, this is the most likely to see some sort of resolution when those DVDs come out in August.
Yeah, it's very possible.
Yeah,
I think there were definitely the fingerprints of... They came in with a very set outline for the end, and then as they were going about making it, they decided to make some changes.
Yeah.
And it feels like that. And I don't think that's a slight on the show. I think the creative process benefits from not being concrete on an idea.
Well, I think it was Noel Murray over at the AV Club, or maybe it was Todd Vanderwerf elsewhere on television on the internet.
There has been a lot of post-Lost discussion that I think we've both listened to. It all kind of jumbled together into a stew.
Well, about how Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse went about developing the show and growing the show after that first season, and that they were kind of just making things up as they went along. And I don't see what the problem is with that, really. That's kind of how you have to approach serialized television.
Right.
And it allowed them to remain vital. I think that's one of the stumbling blocks with a lot of these new shows like Flash Forward and V, et cetera, where they're all chasing that Lost vibe. And any number of those post-Lost premiere knockoffs,
shows,
like Invasion.
Sure. Or The Nine.
The Nine. Yeah, there were any number of them that attempted to do. And I think they got so bogged down and had such a clear idea of what their story was at the end of five seasons that they weren't able to focus on making the day-to-day
stuff
vital.
Work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who are the characters on those shows? I couldn't tell you. And I've watched some of them. I can absolutely tell you the characters on Lost.
Well, Harold Cho's on one of them.
Yeah. John Cho. He plays Harold.
Harold John Cho.
There you go.
The second.
Uh-huh.
Esquire. But part of the problem, I think, is that whereas those shows would have these long dead spaces that they knew exactly where they were going. Not to be confused with the Flash Sideways universe, dead spaces. The Lost kind of always flew by the seat of its pants and was all the more engaging because of it. And unfortunately, due to the serialized nature of storytelling on television, that meant that certain things that probably weren't that big a deal got blown way out of proportion by being at the end of an episode or an act break and then a sting. You know, like, why can't babies be born on the island?
Sure.
And what does that mean or matter?
Yeah, what are Walt's powers?
Although, in all fairness, Walt's powers, and maybe again this is because this was all set up in the first season and I that's back when I was still paying attention to
the little details,
mysteries
stuff.
And the
that's
kind of a big one, you know. That was a motivating force for the entire first season, that Walt had these powers and he had a comic book that had polar bears in it, and was that just a coincidence? And
it was, it ended up
by the way, coincidence.
Yeah, that was a coincidence. By the way, the polar bears were there for a completely different reason. They never explained it, but they gave you enough pieces to put together
that would have been a great finale. Okay. What do all this mean? Just wacky coincidences, guy. Shit happens.
Yeah. Oh.
Ah, damn it.
Oh, well. Let's see here. 41 minutes. Okay.
And I think that ties into, I feel like they had a whole vague idea of, you know, we got to kidnap Walt and we got to kidnap Aaron and these people are important and Claire has to raise Aaron. And there was a whole, like, they got a little baby crazy on Lost.
Yeah,
around season 2 and 3. And then they just kind of let that ball drop. And that wasn't something that they were interested in exploring, because, you know, I think once Jin and Sun's baby was born, that question was put to rest. And I feel like a lot of this stuff is explained away through the Dharma Initiative, too. The Dharma Initiative, who had, you know, it's helpful to have an entirely separate institute that takes care of all your sci-fi gobbledygook.
Exactly.
Really, and in an interesting way, I mean, right, one of the prevailing themes of this show was man of science, man of faith, right?
Sure.
It was really highlighted
which is great, by the way, to have that on a network TV show, to have that question be in active discussion.
Yeah, I mean, that was all of season 2. It was Locke has to push the button every however long it was. and why were there hieroglyphics on that countdown when they run out of countdown?
Well, they meant something.
What did they mean?
To someone.
What?
Remember?
Coincidence!
That if you solve those, you figure out the murder mystery in AI.
If you figure those out, you know who killed Laura Palmer.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, this whole man of science, man of faith thing was clearly something that Lost was very interested in. And then to have Jack switch over and find faith in the last season. You know, and it's interesting to have, once they introduced Jacob, you literally had the man of faith and then the Dharma Initiative standing in as the man of science. And there were these two forces on the island that were doing all of these crazy experiments that from the outside looked probably connected somehow. And then I'm actually really interested to go back and watch the entirety of this series. And pick apart what, because I imagine there was probably a lot more laid in than they expect. I mean, they always said, Lindelof and Cuse always said that they knew what the last couple of scenes were from the beginning. They had that written out, and everything else changed. All the other stuff changed.
Sure.
But they knew, and those last shots were gorgeous.
Beautiful.
Jack laying down, symmetry and closing his eyes.
First of all, the Michael Giacchino score.
Well, Michael Giacchino is amazing. We've discussed
Michael Giacchino.
I liked seeing him. Did you watch the Jimmy Kimmel After special?
No, I didn't. I did.
He was the band leader.
Oh, that's great.
And they did nothing but jazzy riffs on various Lost themes.
Oh, that's great.
It's really good.
You combine that with Vincent kind of trotting up to him and laying, oh, I mean, what are you not going to like that ending?
Yeah. And, you know, it feels like, I feel like season 6 was definitely the faith season, for better or worse. And that rubs a lot of people and a lot of critics the wrong way. I think certainly Devin Faraci of Chud was
not happy.
Furious is the word.
He had it very much tied up in agnosticism and how it was like faulty agnosticism. And it's like, really, that's what you're going to focus on? I was kind of surprised.
It's funny. I mean part of the problem, I agree that, man, it would have been nice if they had a place that wasn't a church.
They
had some place that was important to the outside Lost universe. But they hadn't really ever set up a place like that in LA. I mean, what? Hugo's Chicken Store?
That would have been great, by the way.
Well, you know, the one place...
Mr. Cluck Cluck.
Yeah, the one place that would have made sense would have been Eloise Hawking's crazy pendulum room.
Oh, that would have been good.
That would have made more sense, but I imagine that's an expensive set.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's that big stained glass window behind... really distracting stained glass window behind Christian and Jack in that last scene.
Yeah.
Where it has, like, a cross and the Star of David and, you know, signifiers from every major religion.
It's fraught with meaning.
And then also, like, a rotary wheel, like a rotary club wheel.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was meant to be the island, the donkey wheel, or the...
Could be. There was a really... One of the best things I heard in all the pre and post Lost finale analysis was a conversation between Jeff Rubin at College Humor, who's responsible for this much bandied about 100 Lost unanswered questions that College Humor put up, and Chuck Klosterman from Chuck Klosterman fame.
And, being Chuck Klosterman.
Yeah, exactly. They had a long conversation before the finale, and they talked about the idea of not a specific answers being given, but the idea of a unit set. This idea of that there are enough pieces littered about the series that if you took it piece by piece and you laid it all out in front of you, that you, the viewer, could piece together every mystery on the show. That you were better off not having it spelled out for you. And I think that's true because every time they did literalize it, it was kind of laughable. Yeah. Like what the whispers are.
Like the giant plug in the island.
The giant plug in the island, right. Better that you should make the inferences with what they give you. And it, you know, when you pull back like that, it's more enjoyable. And I thank Lost for having the conviction to actually make the effort to have you, the viewer, do a little work. I think that's one of the reasons why the show has been so successful is that, you know, the onus is on just as much as you, the viewer, as it is you, the passive viewer.
I think that's where a lot of people who say, like, that was dumb, I didn't like it. I don't know why they all talk like that, but they all do. They're also, they wanted answers and they were not willing to engage with the show the way that the creators were hoping. And that's certainly fair. You know, different people want different things out of their entertainment. Certainly their entertainment that involves crazy time travel.
Right.
I think it does come down to these people that are more logically minded versus more, and you know, I feel like I come down on either side of this. I like the ending. I could see where there were, you know, hey, Lost, your sentimentality is showing. You may want to cover that up. But honestly, I mean, the weird thing, I've not seen any real complaints about the extended slow motion hugging.
Right.
In the church at the end, which seems to me, and it's long. There's like a minute and a half of hugging in slow motion.
Dominic Monaghan, very familiar with long slow motion hugging.
I was about to say, you know, when that happened in Lord of the Rings, everyone got furious.
Uh-huh.
But no one has mentioned word one about that in reference to this finale. And the fact that everyone says, like, finale is really great until the last 5 minutes, even, you know, says something about the strength of the characters and how well they've been built up and how well the series as a whole has propelled how the characters have propelled the series as a whole, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Shall we put Lost to bed, maybe give a final thing, you know, state, you know, Rami, who do you think, you know, we're talking about characters. I wanted to take a real quick thing, quick moment and say, Rami, can I get your favorite Lost characters and why?
Oh, God. There were a lot. I loved Ben because Emerson played him in such a way that you really never knew. Good. That he was, whether he was good or whether he was bad, and I think that was a good kind of benchmark for the show because you constantly had people shifting alliances, and it was, you know, depending on any given episode, you didn't know whether a guy was good or bad. I loved Desmond.
Generally bad though.
Huh?
Generally bad.
Yeah, generally he was bad.
I can always pretty much reliably count on Ben Linus to be a jerk.
Yeah. I love Desmond because his episodes were always really, really good.
You know, it's really funny. I was talking to someone the other day about Desmond and why he's like everyone's favorite Lost character. And why his episodes are always so good. And I think it's because the Desmond episodes were a benchmark of what Lost does well, and it was the height of the two things that Lost does well, and it mixes the most crazy science fictiony elements.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest, you know, time jumping electromagnetism, jump, you know, stuck in a hatch underneath an island hitting a computer button every, I don't even remember.
An hour and 18 minutes. Yeah, sure.
But it always paired them. It's like they realized how nerdy all that was, and they paired it with the single strongest emotional thread that the show had ever, that the show ever dealt with. It was his relationship with Penny and just needing to get back to Penny and tying in the constant with an emotional constant. I mean, I think that was probably the smartest thing they did on the series, and that's why the Desmond episodes always tend to, and I don't even, I mean, Penny's had like maybe a grand total of 35 like minutes of screen time. Yeah,
exactly.
Over and six seasons. And yet she's listed as one of people's favorite characters just because of how deftly that storyline was handled.
Yeah. Also, Brian K. Vaughan wrote his big episodes.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Brian K. Vaughan, for people who don't know, is a big time comic book writer.
I'll go into more detail in the show notes.
Fair enough.
In the show. God, who else? Sawyer. It was great to see that character evolve. Was kind of how far you could push a character and how much they could change. Mm-hmm. How, you know, he was very one note when the series started, and by season four, everybody's hero.
I always get surprised when a character who's supposed to be saying funny things on TV is actually funny.
Yep.
It happened with Veronica Mars. Sawyer is the Veronica Mars of the island.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guarantee you will not hear that on any other Lost podcast.
Well, I don't know. How many Lost podcasts are held in mental institutions?
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. Let's see here. I think if there's one actor that kind of...
Rami, you're getting surface on me now. Come on.
What?
Go.
Okay, fine. One actor who absolutely embodies what Lost is about and kind of it was a perfect showcase for his talents. It was
Anna Lucia.
It's Terry O'Quinn as Locke, actually. It was a wonderful, like, you know, he is not who you think of when you think of a lead in a mainstream network TV series, but he absolutely was. He was the show. You know, you saw him transform. You saw him play every kind of emotion in the book. You rooted for him, you hated him, you loved him. It was a wonderful character, both John Locke and
Terry O'Quinn, who's been puttering around for years and years and years, and finally to have a really definitive showcase for his talents. I mean, he was the stepfather.
He was Howard Hughes.
He was Howard Hughes in The Rocketeer. Oh, glorious. Terry O'Quinn in a bad fake mustache and even worse hairpiece.
Oh, so good.
What about
you, Frank? Any favorite characters or moments?
Rami, I felt like you stayed mostly on the surface there. These were the predictable. These were the safe answers.
Okay, all right.
I'm going to start with Frank Lapidus.
Oh, you know what? I'm ashamed that I didn't go there first.
Frank Lapidus. Just a hairy, just angry man. It's like they couldn't get Burt Reynolds, so they got Frank Lapidus.
They got Jeff Fahey. Oh man, it was so great to have a regular. Oh my god, can you imagine a show that gives you Jeff Fahey on a weekly basis? It was glorious.
And the fact that he survived.
Oh, I was so happy.
He just kept surviving,
and he was so.
Stop and think about the timeline of what we saw in the finale.
Yes.
So Jin and Sun's submarine gets sunk as part of
the plan to kill all the candidates.
Yeah, as part of the grand whitewashing of no, come on, only three minorities survived.
Yeah,
there was Milo and
Miles,
that one,
Batmanuel
and Hugo Reyes. Of course Batmanuel survived. Do you fondue? I do fondue.
Shushan, this editorial is wonderful.
God, I hope Nestor Carbonell goes back and does some comedy.
I really do.
He's
he's a good dramatic actor, man.
Notable Cuban, Nestor Carbonell.
There you go.
Yeah, I thought his. I actually thought his episode was the strongest of the season.
It was up there. It was definitely a great one. Really, yeah.
But yeah, Lapidus. So if you stop and you figure it out, the submarine sinks.
Yeah.
And then if you count the number of nights and days that go by in the story before Frank Lapidus rises from the ashes like a phoenix.
Yeah. Like a beautiful, scruffy phoenix.
Crawls his way onto the beach. I literally, in my apartment, when that happened, just yelled, Lapidus!
That was awesome.
As if he was John Goodman in Raising Arizona.
Very
when
nice.
When he crawls his way, it's just like, he was a force, and he wasn't, you know, he didn't give a damn about the crazy going on of your island and whatever. Huh. Was like, I'm just Frank Lapidus.
He was as workmanly as they come.
Yeah, but always a cheerful, you know, not a jerk about it.
No.
Just like no. Uncle Frank Lapidus.
That's right.
And I'm shocked, Rami, to find gambling going on in this establishment. No, that you didn't name Hurley. Hurley
was always
my favorite character. He's, you know, the geek mouthpiece that ultimately ended up being more emotional than anybody else. And
true.
And
when Hurley cried, I would say
when Hurley cries, you get really upset. I mean, yeah, look, Jack cries every 5 minutes, but
sure.
When Hurley cries, that's, and they always save that punch too. Did you notice when they got off the submarine in the finale?
Yeah. The last person
you see cry. It's like, oh, Jack's sad, and oh, Kate's sad, and oh, God, Hurley, no.
I want to hug you. Oh, poor guy.
He also
does what any nerd who'd gone back in time would do, and that is rewrite.
One of my favorite moments in my favorite title of anything ever. The episode called "Some Like It Hoth."
Yeah. So good.
Where he's just him and Miles tooling around, and he doesn't say we could write Star Wars. He could say we could write The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, exactly. Because it is 1970. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
But yeah, Hurley as an emotional. I mean, once too often they did go to the Hurley hangs a lantern on something. Hanging a lantern on something is an old screenwriting term for if something is unbelievable, just have someone say, "Hey, it's unbelievable."
it's interesting, the writer's aware of it. Lapidus did that a little bit too.
Yeah, Lapidus did that. What the hell is going on this crazy island?
I guess she found her voice.
Lapidus!
That guy's great.
Who else? I mean, Hurley. Hurley's great. Yeah, clearly Ben was. I mean, Ben really. The presence of Henry Gale and then Ben Linus really galvanized Lost at a period where it was kind of ambling. Richard Alpert, I thought, was great once we got to know him a little bit more and he started flipping out. I loved that Richard Alpert was flipping out this season.
Yeah. The character who had so previously been kind of in control. It's great to kind of see him lose all of it.
Yeah, totally. I feel like there's maybe one more.
Oh, I'll tell you who's a good one. Faraday. Jeremy Davies.
Oh, yeah. Well, now we're just listing the nerds in love, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I was thinking about this the other day. Were there any openly gay characters in Lost?
You know, I remember reading back when the show started, someone suggesting that before they showed a lot of his backstory, that Jack was going to be gay. And I always liked that idea, but it never played through.
Well, yeah, it was just weird, right? I mean, we covered a lot of bases here. And
Mr. Echo was gay.
Right? Huh?
Let's add one more shade to that character.
Let's add a shade.
We've been very neglectful of female performances, I think. And I think...
Elizabeth Mitchell.
Yeah, Elizabeth Mitchell as Juliet was great.
She
had to make that relationship with Sawyer work in like one scene, and they totally nailed it.
And the fact that she started off as being so cold and progressed to being such a warm and emotionally guided.
Yeah,
character.
She was like a really manipulative, evil.
She was. Oh, no, she was one of the others. She was. Yeah. And you didn't feel bad for her until Ben Linus set up a creepy ass dinner date.
Do you think, let me ask you this, do you think, talking about the female characters on the show, do you think this is a show that utilized its female characters well? Were they victims? Were they, you know, just love objects?
No, I don't think they were. Well, I mean, it's tricky.
It's tricky,
right? Because for every scene where you have Kate, you know, pulling a gun on anyone, frequently, you know, for every scene you have Kate, you have another bit where they're trying to force the Kate and Jack relationship down your throat. A relationship that, I mean, possibly the least amount of chemistry of the whole cast, right? But it just happened because she was the female lead and he was the male lead.
Right.
You know, and it's tricky. And that's not to say about anything about either of them as performers or, you know, I as people who have heard me talk about Speed Racer, I love Matthew Fox. And I think Evangeline Lilly is also a very fine performer. And some of those, some of her flashback episodes were
rough.
Yeah, really outstanding.
Oh, really? Oh, I would disagree, but okay.
No, it depends on the. I really like the first one. The first one was great.
I like the one with Nathan Fillion.
I didn't like that one.
Oh, ew.
Yeah.
Why do you hate Beautiful Things?
What? But yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, certainly Juliet was uber competent. You know,
she was
smart, and she, you know, through tears, you know, was trying to blow up the Jughead bomb. And
Then
you have like Boone. I mean, not Boone.
Shannon.
You know,
who's kind of as vapid and as unappealing a character as
I felt bad that
see.
I felt bad that once Shannon died, a lot of that was settled. A lot of that had to be settled on Claire. You know, a lot of the victim mentality.
Yeah.
With Claire and Aaron.
Do you think, like, here's the thing, like,
and,
they had
and Son was competent, and you know, Son was certainly. I mean, honestly, Son is the second lead. You know, second lead female. You know, there's no other female character that we had more access to besides Kate than Son.
Right. She was actually, if I'm looking at, she was in as many episodes. She's the only female character in as many episodes as Kate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they did well. I mean, part of the problem is that those characters never really seemed integral, right? Because if you're talking about characters that are integral, you're talking about Jack and you're talking about Locke.
Right.
And very seldom did Kate interact with Locke or... you know, it's funny. It's like the main, it's like no matter what was happening in the 100 other tangents, it was always Jack and Locke.
Right.
Which is why I loved that scene in the cave in the finale where, the Loch Ness monster, fake Locke, is talking about, hey, this is just like us looking down in the hatch. And Jack turns around and says, you are a perversion of the memory.
It was a very strong moment for that character.
But I think that's part of the problem with Kate is that I'm always way more interested in the dynamic between Jack and Locke than I am between Jack and Kate. Interesting question. No, Miles isn't gay. Daniel Faraday isn't gay. Charles Widmore. Maybe Charles Widmore turned later in life.
But it's possible.
Explored his deep-seated repressed urges.
Was Anna Lucia? Maybe no.
Anna Lucia was totally gay.
There you go.
She made out with Jack, didn't she?
Yeah. Oh, I'll tell you, was gay. Mr. Friendly. Mr. Friendly was gay.
Who's Mr. Friendly?
MC Gainey. He's one of the others.
Oh, Mr. Friendly was gay.
Yeah, they actually made a point of showing that the character was gay, but they didn't really push him up.
Horrible. On that. Yeah. Hold on. Rousseau was gay.
I don't think that's true.
I don't think that's right. Look, they're making it really hard for the inevitable triple X porn parody of Lost.
Ugh. Lost in my pants.
That's not a good thing.
I know.
Needless
to say, the ending is very satisfying.
And on that note.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Rami, so in the past couple of weeks, we've caught some of the summer movie pate.
Uh-oh, yeah.
Palette?
A palette, for which we can sample.
Yes, we can taste and pick and choose. And we both saw, what's the name of this movie? I can't remember.
If only there was some sort of helpful theme song.
MacGruber!
There it is.
Yeah. I can't tell you how much I was laughing at the beginning of that movie.
Oh, yeah, where they do the symphonic,
the symphonic version
of the MacGruber choral
theme.
Yeah.
And then they cut to him in a tree playing a saxophone.
So good. MacGruber, a very enjoyable time at the movies. I think we were the two people in America who saw it.
No, you know, there's been a lot of, what's the opposite of backlash?
Unlash.
Yeah. Rehab.
Under retology.
Under, yeah. There's been a lot of people that I've seen in,
on the Twitters.
On the Twitters and online who are all immediately hailing MacGruber as an instant classic that'll be discovered on video in 10 years.
Yeah, I can see this doing very well on like a Comedy Central or a TV.
Well, the same way that Hot Rod did. I mean, a lot of people have seen Hot Rod, you know.
Now and
my cousins who don't watch anything watched Hot Rod, and I mean, it's and they quote it left and right. But yeah, MacGruber's like a different animal. I was a little underwhelmed by MacGruber in the theaters. I feel like it probably does have one of those vibes where the more I think back on it, the more I did actually enjoy it. You know, it's got kind of a Walk Hard vibe to it, where I wasn't blown away when I saw it, and then I'm sure I'll see it eventually again. You know, but I was a little disappointed. I mean, they hewed very close to the genre.
Yes,
right.
Close. Would you say that's to its detriment or to its to its advantage?
Here's the thing: Jorma Taccone is one of the three Lonely Island guys that are responsible, along with Andy Samberg and Akiva
Schaffner.
Schaffner, who are responsible for all the SNL digital shorts. And I would have liked to have seen a bit more. I feel by hampering themselves in this style, it killed the potential for some inventiveness.
Oh, some really?
Cleverness. Yeah, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more comedy inventiveness, you know, going on. Like, you know, again, I just mentioned Walk Hard, but that movie, you know,
that's stylistically all over the place.
It always ends up getting back into the root. Again, it's unfair because it's a different type of parody,
sure.
You know. And honestly, I feel like this movie lives and dies in the performance of Will Forte.
Yes.
Which is
just a madman to think that this was, I mean, how could this ever have been embraced by the mainstream? It's so beyond out there. It's so unrepentantly.
Well,
demented.
He's so committed.
Yes.
And
and
for the first like 15 minutes of the film, the only laughs I got were from his sole amount of commitment to the character, you know, and just like he inhabits it 100%. So every little like head turn becomes a joke.
He's very much nailed that action hero style of, well, what if I said like this, and then I'll say this, and then I'll finally make my last point like
I'm
this.
Laughing. Yeah. I mean, it is, it's a straight up, you know, parody, but there's not much else to it there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no real sly commentary, and this isn't like something that's that hard to deconstruct. Like, you know, it's funny. One of the weakest gags in the film, and look, the film has a lot of really strong gags.
Yes,
particularly the ghost scene in the graveyard.
Oh my god! Yeah.
See, I would have liked to see more stuff like that. Well, not like
some ghost sex.
Yeah.
not funny on Grey's Anatomy. Hilarious in MacGruber.
And then they cut away to watch the grave digger watching it, and there's nothing there. But it's, you know, like it's funny to the film's weakest gags are the ones that are inherent to the setup, you know, like I thought the recurring gag of having MacGruber build things out of like tiny paper clips and whatever were not very strong. Because
well, the payoff of him discovering guns is pretty funny.
That is good. Yeah, when he finally discovers a gun. But like him like building a tennis ball bomb that fizzles. And it's not like...
Yeah.
It's not... And Kristen Wiig didn't do much. She wasn't given a lot to do.
Yeah, it's very much Will Forte's show.
Yeah, and I feel sorry for
anyone. It's a shame that Val Kilmer couldn't do more.
No, I actually think Val Kilmer did it exact. I think Val Kilmer played it exactly right.
I love the ending. I will say I was not expecting that particular resolution with the character.
Well, the backstory of that character was great too.
Yes.
Right, the whole Val Kilmer. The thing
oh, yeah.
Like, Val Kilmer, you know, MacGruber hates Val Kilmer because...
He killed
his wife on their wedding day.
Except...
Only MacGruber then revealed... He's like, I don't know why Van Kunth...
Dieter Van Kunth, yeah.
Hated us so much. And then he goes on to reveal that he, like, stole Dieter's girlfriend and stole the girl... His fiance
on the wedding day.
Was on his own wedding day. I thought that was really fun. And,
when
it pushes towards that realm of meta-commentary... Then the film gets interesting. But when it falls back on just, like, the standard stuff you'd expect to see from a MacGyver parody...
Sometimes it gets in the realm of, like, an Austin Powers kind of, like, here's someone in an action-packed situation, and he's generally fairly incompetent.
Yeah. And that celery. Huh?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that was a running gag that... Well, whatever.
I mean, you knew where it was going.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
And figuratively, you knew where that joke was going.
But on a whole, I like MacGruber. I thought it could have been a little... It's not Anchorman.
No, it is not.
But what is? That's an unfair comparison.
Right.
Hey, look, it's not penicillin.
if you saw the previews for this movie and thought it looked interesting, go quick, because it's not much long.
That thing will be out of theaters right quick. I mean, it didn't help that it was opening opposite Shrek.
True.
Shrek and the Shrek-tastics.
Shrek, I've lost my... I'm bored to Shrek with this.
I'm so ogre this.
Redonkulous. it's a catastrophe. All right, so Frank, you saw Prince of Persia.
I did, and
thus derailing our plan for both of us to go see Sex and the City 2 this week. We actually did seriously talk about going to see it.
I'm not. We still have not. This discussion is not over.
Right. Yeah.
We may still go see it.
Katie was very. She had some strong words to say about our casually passing by some of the more female oriented films.
Oh really?
Summer. Yeah.
Like what?
She felt that we were being unfair.
We talked about MacGruber a lot.
we'll keep the Sex and the City discussion.
Was it just Sex and the City? I'm trying to think. I can't.
No. Here, I'll tell you what she said.
Letters to Juliet. Does she want us to talk about Letters to Juliet?
We were a little dismissive to Letters to Juliet, and hold on, there was some other stuff too. I will tell you what she said. She said.
Is this a screed? Is this a missive?
It was kind of missive-y.
Is she the Martin Luther of Cave 76?
Not so.
Did she post it on? Did she post it on your wall?
Yeah, it was on my blog.
With a pike.
She said,
"I don't know much about organized religion."
Sex and the City 2. She said we passed over the following movies: Sex and the City 2, Step Up 3D, Twilight Eclipse, Babies, Letters to Juliet. A lot of these movies.
Okay, hold on.
Will be dumb, she admits, but does that mean there's nothing to say about them? Can a dance movie work in 3D? Why does Twilight keep changing directors? And is it having any impact?
Twilight keeps changing directors because they need to shoot a film every year.
Right. Babies is supposed to be really
beautifully
filmed documentary. Is the subject matter so beneath you that you can't give it a few minutes to your consideration?
Yeah, Babies are so beneath me. You know what? I'm going to say it right now, and I think, Rami, you'll agree.
Yeah?
Cave 76 hates Babies.
Oh, my God. I don't know if I can follow you there, Frank.
Thank you for your support, Rami.
I'm all for you guys talking about the stuff you're actually interested in, but if you're going to do a roundup, probably want to strive a bit more for balance. That's what she said.
All right. Sex and the City 2.
We're going to go see it.
Because for this very reason, we will go see it.
But let's talk about the other movie that came out.
Hold on. I feel like you're going to wish that we hadn't once we talk about it.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
What else? Step up to the
3D.
3D for you and me.
Yes.
Well,
I mean,
if we're going to talk about dance movies that can work in 3D, you need look no further than the film adaptation of Kiss Me, Kate. It was a musical. It was in 3D. It was awful.
Yes. Well, there's lots of reasons for that.
But you know what? I also think that just the style and the energy of the way that those films is shot is going to cause a lot of headaches once you add another dimension to it. You know, it's a lot of like quick cuts to canted angles of, it'll be like watching John Adams on HBO in 3D.
Martha, I need to talk to you about something.
And Martha!
You can't see it right now, but I've stuck my hand forward in an amusing way.
Martha, let's crunk.
Okay, so Prince of Persia.
Prince of Persia, I actually liked a lot.
Okay. I did not see this movie, but...
Were you planning on seeing it? I'm just kidding.
I was honestly...
If you were even remotely curious, I would go see it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, for you. I mean, I don't know if I can...
Yeah.
But it's a big...
Can I tell you what kind of helped sway me? Mm-hmm. Was the AV Club review where they compared Gemma Arterton to Daphne Zuniga in Spaceballs?
It's Gemma Arterton.
Gemma Arterton. Yeah. Yeah, if you want to have me see a movie,
they did that negatively, and it's and it definitely comes through, especially since they said that. it definitely. I was watching. I was like, "Yep." Why isn't Jake Gyllenhaal carrying comically oversized luggage through this desert?
So you said this movie works for you, Frank? Would you say better than Clash of the Titans?
Yeah, easily.
Which is kind of our watermark for middling to entertaining summer fun this year.
Yeah, because it was going for. I mean, here's the thing. This was the first movie that Jerry Bruckheimer wanted to. That wasn't a Pirates movie that Jerry Bruckheimer produced and wanted to slap a coat of Pirates paint on. You know, he was looking for his next adventure. You know, quirky, not quirky, but like, you know, rollicking good time adventure film, not an action film.
Right.
And at a lot of places, it really works. The story's engaging. You honestly are not sure. There's a whole, you know, it's not particularly typical. It's not like this is the bad guy, this is the good guy, and we've got to save this. It actually has to do a lot with these three brothers who are all the princes of Persia. And the ascendancy to the throne.
Omar, Babkak, Kasim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think actually one of them is, well, hold on. Jake Gyllenhaal's character is Kastin?
Is I'm glad the film made enough of an impact on you that you still remember the main character's name.
No, he was always, here's the thing about Jake Gyllenhaal. When he's being like, there was this.
Is he charming? Is he convincing? Is it action?
Oh no, he's pretty charming. You know, it's weird though because he does definitely have these like, the movie runs into real problems whenever an actual Persian wanders on, like an extra wanders into the on screen, like in the background, and you see, oh, these people aren't Persian at all. Particularly Jake Gyllenhaal, who does really look surfery. You know, a friend of mine who saw it said this is the first truly metrosexual action hero we've had. He's got like two little beads in his front strand of hair. But every time they give him a close up, not every time, but there were a couple of instances where they give him a close up where he looks a little bit doofy. You know, he's just like, oh, I'm in a movie. Hey, that's me, Jake Gyllenhaal.
You remember, guys?
It's like,
Rebel Boy, y'all like that.
Well, and part of this is the editing too. And I mentioned this to you on the Twitter. It feels this movie had three different editors, and it feels like what Mike Newell, the director, he also directed Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other more important films. It feels like the movie that he shot and the movie he had in mind was diametrically opposed to the type of film, either to the editing style, you know, this quick MTV editing style, and stuff is, or maybe what happened is they saw a cut of the way Mike Newell shot the film and they brought in extra editors to kind of jazz it up and they did some reshoots and added stuff. Mm-hmm. The movie that Mike Newell was shooting, I was very interested in watching. One thing that I will say, well, I mean, so all the fight scenes are, and this is definitely Mike Newell, this was not some second unit director or whatever. Sword fights should not be shot in, I really don't like close hand-to-hand combat. You know, the shaky cam, the kind of Batman Begins, Bourne trilogy, you know, what's happening? Punching over here. I mean, you know, part of swashbuckling is I want to be dazzled by the elegance of the fight scenes.
Yes.
And what is happening. And I think that's one thing that Pirates of the Caribbean, the whole trilogy got really, really right in terms of the shooting. It's like every time I think of the first movie, I immediately think of that opening scene, the first fight between Orlando Bloom and Johnny Depp in the sword making, the swordsmith's office. And that's a very elegant and well choreographed fight scene. And whenever you go in for these herky jerky close ups, it becomes a little, you can't really tell what's going on and it seems cheap and easy. But there are some moments of the big, like the crazy parkour acrobatics, you know, which is like, I mean, Prince of Persia, I forget who said it, but Prince of Persia, the game in the 80s, essentially invented parkour.
Yeah,
true. You know, and some of the shots of the part of the parkour style action of him jumping around through different the streets and hanging on, poles and stuff and jump and all these crazy jumps and flips were shot fairly wide, you know, so you could really see what Jake Gyllenhaal's stuntman was doing. the editing was like, there's a big chase through the rooftops of Persia, where there's a shot of just a silhouette of Jake Gyllenhaal and he stands there, against like a brown clay, roof and it's just the shadow and he stands and he's running and then it cuts and then there's some action and then it cuts back to a shot and to that same shot of a silhouette of like hundreds of guards following and it's clear mm-hmm. that was all meant to be one shot but they mm-hmm. threw in some crazy, you know, sword clanging and action. It's like they felt that the people would get bored with the pace of a traditional adventure movie, so they MTV'd it up a little bit. And they same thing I was mentioning to you on Twitter yesterday, how they added a whole subplot, not a subplot, but an added, they felt that the threat. So part of the plot, the master villain's plan is revealed and he wants to go back and change all of time. You know, the movie, for people who don't know, because honestly, watching the trailer isn't going to tell you any of this, or the commercials or anything. You have no idea what it is, which is really to the detriment of the film because, because you don't really know what the movie's about, all you can see is Jake Gyllenhaal pretending to be Persian. And that's kind of tainted the discussion of this film. But the idea is that there's a weird Iraq war
analog,
yeah, where it's Persia has been told that this smaller kingdom that is run by Princess Gemma Atherton has been concealing weapons or making weapons and selling them to Persian enemies.
Oh my God! Are you kidding me?
So in this case, Persia is America. Follow me on this.
Okay.
And this other country is Iran. I guess Iran.
Okay. And apparently,
it gets more in depth.
Okay.
Hold on. Yeah. Here's the thing. This movie did take some rather liberal, not that liberal politically, but some liberal, some liberty. It took some liberties with the current events, shall we say? Alfred Molina's character is a small business owner who runs. He identifies himself as the small businessman who runs an ostrich racing
arena outside, which is fun. I mean, this is a good, fun, wacky concept. Runs it in this like nether region with all these escaped slaves, and they all live, you know, off the grid because they don't want to be taxed to death by the Persian government. And he's like, he stands in for a teabagger, but he's comical. And
he was the Captain Jack of this movie.
A little bit. I mean, in that he's like wacky and saucy.
And everyone in the audience really liked him.
Whenever he mentioned any of that, like, you know, they're taxing me too much, everyone cracked up. I'm like, but he gives a fine performance, and he's got a lot of energy. I mean, nice. Really a lot of energy. That's nice. And the characters are more well-defined than in Clash of the Titans, too.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There's a really cool, just cool character ideas. Like, there's this race of professional knife throwers.
Uh-huh.
And the leader of this race has a knife with his own face carved into the hilt. Like, it's a bust of his own face. It's really cool. Oh, I don't think I ever explained. Okay, so they've gone to invade this thing because they claim that there are weapons there, but really...
are you still explaining the plot of this monstrosity?
Well, I went off on a couple of...
Okay, all right.
Tangents. Yeah, we're the topical tangent.
Got it. Right.
Yeah. Is that they are going to... what they're really after is this secret... they've planted these weapons there, and what they're really looking for is this... Dagger. This dagger that has the ability, it holds a small amount of the sands of time, that has the ability to reverse a couple of, I think like a minute or something of time. Uh-huh. So the, and no one knows what happens except for the person who clicks the dagger. You know, so they go back in time and they have a repeat shot. And this is a mechanic that's carried over from the video game. So what they're actually looking for is the dagger and also the repository of the sands of time, because the big bad guy wants to reverse all of time and make things different so that his life is better. And in doing so, erasing most of the history of the main characters. But it's like they decided that this was too nebulous a threat. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't clear. So the scene where that is revealed is immediately followed by a hastily green screen scene of Gemma Atherton saying, "Oh, and also if he tries to do this, the world will explode." And then there are scenes during the big climactic finale where the villain and Jake Gyllenhaal are fighting over the sands of time, and then just casually dropped in, not even shots of other actors reacting to it, is just scenes of Armageddon, like shots of giant sandstorms wiping out the city. But not actually affecting the characters, because they're all in this, like, again, fun Prince of Persia-esque cavern. And there's a lot of, like, fun, really, like, pulpy, adventure-y stuff in here.
Uh-huh. But it feels like it's kind of getting sidetracked by some of the other stuff that's kind of going on.
A little bit, but, you know, I was happy for it because it wasn't as predictable as I thought it was going to be, which is... great, you know, there were little twists and turns here and there, and the dynamic of these three brothers, one of whom the film begins with their father, the sultan or the king or whatever they decide to call him in this not quite Persia, being murdered, and there's a frame up plot, and you know, there's a brother who's the angry, you know, sort of hot headed brother, and then there's Jake Gyllenhaal, and who's blamed for the murder, and then there's the even-headed brother who rises to the throne and has to then go pursue Jake Gyllenhaal. And the question of, you know, the film actually does keep you guessing quite a bit, which is good. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of Indiana Jones-esque bits because everyone's like, "Who's got the dagger?" and Gemma Atherton is constantly trying to steal the dagger away from Jake Gyllenhaal, and they have some fun patter. I mean, they don't have the best chemistry in the world, but I really dug the hell out of this film a lot. It had a lot of flaws, and you really don't want to analyze it for its political content, either of the story or of the fact that the spray tanning budget on this film must have been obscene.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I would actually recommend it if you're looking for a pirates-y type movie this summer. I mean, this is the fun summer. adventure movie.
You know, would you say it is better than the Pirates of the Caribbean sequels?
Well, that's difficult for me to say because there's a lot about the sequels that infuriates me solely because of the potential that was present. You know, like the whole overexposing of Jack Sparrow and forcing him to conform to a protagonist's narrative. But, I mean, there's a lot of really fun stuff in there as well. I will say there's maybe not a really definitive – maybe a couple, but – they have some fun action sequences, but there's not a definitive action sequence in this film. The way that Pirates 2 had that amazing like water wheel fight.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, there are not a lot of indelible images in this film. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe there's a fight where they're all sleeping, they're camped out, and then there are these assassins that use snakes. And so you see all these snakes crawling underneath the sand and come up and they start killing everybody. And then Jake Gyllenhaal, you know, hits the button on the dagger and he goes back in time and kills all the snakes before everyone else. And he passes it off as like, I'm just really good. You know, in his cocky Han Solo. Like, it's clear that, that Han Solo and Princess Leia were the template for this. And I think that may be why they are specifically, AV Club invokes Spaceballs. But yeah, I thought it was I thought it was a lot of fun.
Okay.
I thought it was a lot of fun. And if you're looking for a if you're looking to fulfill your swashbuckling content this summer, I would say check it out.
All right. Cool, good to know.
Yeah.
All right.
I think that wraps up
another pleasurable episode. Oh, it's been too long. I'm really glad we're back in the swing of it.
Yeah. Well, if you want to contact us, you could always reach us at cave76podcast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. Or you can check us out on Twitter. I am at thesickness83.
And I am at Frank Angones. That's A-N-G-O-N-E-S.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here. You can always check out my blog where I've got show notes. That's sicknesscinema.com. And you can check out our Facebook group page. Just type in cave76. And, of course, we're always on iTunes, so please rank us and leave a review.
Yep. Oh, wait, hold on.
Yeah, what's up, Frank?
Hold on, Rami, I feel like we're forgetting something.
Forgetting something. Yeah. Forgetting something. Forgetting something. Forgetting something.
Oh! Frank's Lost Theory of the Week!
Wait, no, but...
No, Rami, we gotta do it. It's Frank's Lost Theory of the Week. It's the big last Frank's Lost Theory of the Week.
But wait a minute, If Lost
Cue
is
the intro.
Over, but
it's Frank's Lost Theory of the Week. Come on, Rami. I know you want to.
It's Frank's Lost Theory of the Week.
Ba-dum-bum-bum, zibbity bow bow.
God, this is so strange. It's like I feel like it's I've been here before. And it's been there at the same.
Dub-a-dub-bum. Ba-dee-bee-bee-bee-bee-bee-bee-bee-bee.
It's Frank's Lost Theory of the Week.
Ba-dum-bum.
Lost.
See, did that feel familiar, Rami? Do you get what's going on right now? Do you understand what's happening?
It's like I'm having this intense, powerful flashback.
Slash
sideways. All the terrible attempts. It's all happening so fast, it's flushing into my head like a wave of emotions. What's going on?
Rami.
What?
Rami.
What?
Do you remember now?
Oh my God.
Yeah?
Is it true? Can it really be true, Frank?
Yes, it is. You remember, so you remember about the dinosaur.
Yes.
Yeah.
The dinosaur, and I remember about the, the escape from New York island.
Yeah.
And I remember the genie, and I remember every ridiculous theory because it all happened at once. It all happened. Oh God!
And do you remember all of the roofies that you took?
No, I don't.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That was kind of the point of that adventure.
Oh my God, Frank!
Yeah.
Frank,
yeah.
Are we dead?
Do you want to be?
No.
Well, then no, we're not!
All right.
We're probably dead, though.
Alright. Well,
well,
I guess until next time, let them all from a sideways world.
Yeah, from except, a nebulous half purgatory type thing.
Yes. Let them all go to the mythological construct devised by Hurley and Ben.
Except Cave 76.
Lost.